Warning, the Geek Cave can at times contain mature language and immature humor. The Geek Cave, brought to you by BuzzTime, great minds drink alike. Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from your past so you can look rad today. And GameStop, power to the players. Hey nerds, we understand you. Drop those controllers, lose the wizard hat, and ready your Cheetos. It's time for some hard-hitting talk about the movies, books, and games you love. So get ready, oh searcher of useless knowledge. It's time to step into the Geek Cave. Now, broadcasting from a top-secret and totally awesome hidden base, I'm Kent Harris, and here's Darren Wright, Justin White, and Chad Savage.
And welcome to the Geek Cave Podcast movie segment. I'm Darren.
I'm Justin.
I'm Chad, and welcome. We are being brought by Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from your past so you can look rad today. BuzzTime, great minds drink alike, and GameStop, power to the player. Hey, Darren.
Yo.
I hear you had an interview with somebody.
Oh, yeah. And the next guest on the Geek Cave Podcast is a British actress who's done a lot of stuff, European touring theater, independent films, numerous short films, and is interested in playing a character that everyone has a lot of really strong feelings about, Kate Davis Speak. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for asking me to be on your show. It's a real pleasure to be here.
That's absolutely our pleasure to have you. First of all, I wanted to say congratulations. I saw you recently got married.
I did indeed, yes. So I got married 3 weeks ago, and that's why I'm still just about getting used to my new name as well. But it was brilliant and fantastic, and I'm just about coming back to Earth now, so it's great.
Well, if you're looking for her on Twitter, by the way, it's just at Kate Davis Speak, D-A-V-I-E-S Speak. And, you know, she's really good about reaching out to her fans. And obviously, when we stumbled across your page, saw that you're training, you really, really want the job of Batgirl. So I know that Joss Whedon still hasn't cast yet. Tell us a little bit about how that's going.
Thank you for asking. Well, it's just a funny thing that kind of escalated. Basically, I'm a mad fan of sort of action heroines anyway. I love playing strong, empowered female roles. And for quite some time, because I'm into sort of health and fitness, and whenever I go out training, I wear a different superhero top. And one of my favorites for ages has been my Batman / Batgirl top that I wear training. And people have said for ages, oh, you know, if they ever cast for Batgirl, you should go for the role. Didn't think anything of it. And then a couple of months back, people let me know that Joss Whedon publicly said that he was actually looking for an unknown actress to play the part of Batgirl. And I kind of made it quite public on social media that it would be a role that I'd be interested in playing. And I'm so thankful and just thrilled that I've got such a brilliant bunch of supportive followers and friends on social media. And they kind of went to town on it, setting up a hashtag saying Kate Davis for Batgirl, and including me in all kinds of tweets, but fan art, and just they believed in the prospect of me playing the role, and it kind of gave me a bit of burst of enthusiasm too. So yeah, it's just kind of something that's kicked off on social media, but it's at the forefront of my mind, and I've spoken to various independent filmmakers who are keen to maybe write me a proof of concept script that I could maybe put out there as a bit of a showreel to showcase myself playing the role how I see her, because I've looked at different depictions of the character and I have kind of ways that I sort of see her going. But also stunt choreographers who are keen to do fight sequences with me where we could showcase the kind of fight style that we believe Batgirl would do. And anyway, it's kind of it's a bit of fun, but it's kind of a bit of fun that has legs to it. You know, people kind of keep it going and generate a bit of excitement about it. And I just thought, why not? I love these kind of roles and I've got nothing to lose by just putting it out there that it's something I'd like to play. So that's kind of where we're at the moment.
Very cool. I found Maria Fernandez's art that kind of has your head on a Batgirl suit, and it really does, it fits. It looks like it could work.
If I looked that good in the Batgirl suit, then I would definitely be all over it. That itself is something worth training for every time I hit the gym. So, yeah. No, it's great, though. I mean, and people like Maria and various others, again, it's their support that actually kind of motivates and drives me forward. So the whole thing is more than anything else. It's just a reminder that using social media and a chance to actually engage and interact with your fan base or just, you know, followers or what have you, it's nice. It's kind of a game, but it's a professional game as well. You know, you can really see what you can do with it. And if Joss Whedon or any of his casting team happen to stumble upon any of the tweets, then I only have my my fan base to thank for that. So it's you know, it's worth a shot, to put it that way.
Well, Joss, we definitely hope you're listening. Now, moving, switching gears a little bit, you played Nicole on Horizon. This was a nifty sci-fi series. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to do that.
Oh, thank you. Well, Nicole's actually one of my favorite characters that I've had the opportunity to play. Mainly because as a web series, it's something that's accessible to everyone. It's not easy for actors to get roles on television. So by kind of working on web series and things, we're actually able to put something out there that people can watch free of charge. It's easy to access and it's episodic. So it gives us a chance to play a character for a long period of time, which is what I most enjoyed. Now, I've worked on 2 seasons of Horizon. I think that's probably where we're going to draw the line, unless things are taken further. But it's a sci-fi that's actually shot in my hometown, Bristol, which is brilliant as an actor to be able to work on the doorstep, because very often I have to travel to London or further afield and work throughout Europe. So to be able to work close to home was brilliant. But the character was actually written for me. I'd worked with some of the film team previously on a short film called The Levels. And I, knowing me, I was probably banging on and on about the kind of characters that I like to play. And it usually involves guns and running away from creatures or what have you. And then they started talking to me about the concept of Horizon, which is, in a nutshell, is an alien invasion in Bristol. But it's more about what it does to the humans, like the humanity, how they turn on each other, how they reach out for friends and family in a crisis. And it really highlights the difference in the characters of the show. And I thought, well, that show sounds brilliant. And they said, well, funnily enough, we're glad you're interested because one of the characters was written for you. Now, Nicole is, she's not a very likable character at first, but for that reason, I absolutely loved her because she was, I hope, quite a polar opposite to how I think that I am. She's very self-centered. She doesn't care about anybody else. She appears really not to care about anything. In one of the shows, she's more interested in the cost of her expensive suit and her expensive handbag that go missing in this invasion, rather than the car crash that's happened and the child that's dying on the side of the road. So she's quite shallow. But what's great about working in a series is you get more of a chance to take your character on a bit of an arc, a bit of a journey. And through the events of what happened, you find out a little bit more about the character. And you find out she's maybe not as bad as you first think she is. And I hope that people really start to like her by the end. I'd say that particularly in season 2, which I don't imagine I can say too much about at the moment because it's not released yet.
Right.
I think you see the real Nicole, and she's certainly a character that I can relate to a little bit more. So I found it quite exciting as an actor to take a character from start to finish and really show very, very varying sides of her. So the whole experience is fantastic. And I'm sad that it's over, but I'm very, very excited for it to come out for people to watch as well.
Well, and as a side note to our listeners, we will be putting, when this episode goes up at deepcavepodcast.com, we'll have the filmography and the links to Horizon and a few other things that Kate has done, so you can enjoy it yourself as well. Looking through your filmography, definitely seems like horror is one of your favorite genres.
Yeah, I'm glad, really. Deep down, I mean, some actors don't like to be kind of bracketed into a certain genre, but if I'm being completely honest with you, I have been a horror fan since I was far too young to be watching horror. I probably watched my first horror at about 6 years old. I love films that are predominantly driven by women. You know, women get quite good roles in horror, and sometimes it involves screaming and running away, but very often they can be taken on quite interesting journeys as well. I did my first horror, I think proper horror, maybe back in 2013. The first release horror was a film called Beautiful People, which I shot in Italy. And it's a very strange film. Some people like it and others don't, but it's a cross genre. They tried to go down the same road as something like Dusk Till Dawn. So the film starts out as a home invasion and ends up as a massive zombie film, because why not? You can do what you want. But it was great fun. I just remember working with the other actors on that set in a stunning part of Italy. And we're filming in the woods about 2 a.m. And I was like, do you know what? I'm living the dream. This is me doing exactly what I feel like I was destined to do from a very young age. And the great thing about horror is you can kind of build up a bit of a horror fan base. So people almost want to see you shoot more and more to see what you kind of do with it. And I've made some good connections with horror filmmakers. And I'm pleased to say that, you know, I have a string of horrors behind me, but I've also got some to shoot coming up as well. I've got quite a few to shoot this year. So it's a very happy part of my career, and I'm quite proud to be a horror actor.
Yeah, it seems it looks like you're right now working on a film called Dead Air. And this one's got our interest because it involves puppets, women in horror, kind of comedy, a little bit of something for everyone. Well, maybe not the kids.
It's, I mean, but maybe even fractionally the kids, because I'm really excited about this film. We only just started full-on pre-production the weekend just gone. We started doing some of the live cast modeling, where you you basically make a human cast so that they can use the prosthetics for the show.
Right.
And I mean, what makes that cool is it's all practical effects rather than CGI, which I'm a big fan of, actually, being a fan of sort of early horror. But the reason why I say kids might enjoy it as well, because I guess if we could liken it to any other films, I would say it's a split between a film called Josie and the Pussycats. So it's about a female-led kind of punk band. They're all congregated together on an aeroplane flight on their way to their final gig. And then lo and behold, during that flight, they are then attacked by these tiny, quite cute-looking creatures that I would say look a bit more like Gizmo from Gremlins than anything else. And I really can't wait to start shooting it. I can't wait to meet the puppets. That's the bit I'm most excited about. Yeah, I think when you get a script and you read it, and as you read it, you think, I would definitely go and watch this film. It's a good sign for making it, you know. I can't wait to get on set. And that was cemented in further when I actually met the cast and crew at the weekend. So, yeah, bring it on. I really can't wait. I'm really excited about it.
Nice. Well, we're looking forward to seeing that. And just, again, really appreciative of you taking some time and talking with us. And please keep us posted on the Batgirl front, because we'd love to see that come to fruition for you.
Thanks very much. I mean, it's an absolute honor to have people ask to speak to me. You know, I am an indie actor, so I find a lot of work for myself. I never really know whether my work's being seen or reached out there, but any kind of response, reaction, questions, anything involving my career, I'm really grateful for. And, you know, as I say, it's the support of everyone that's actually getting me anywhere in the industry. So I'll gladly keep working through it, but also I'm very happy to feed it back to you as well. So thank you.
And again, that's Kate Davis Speak, and we'll have her IMDb at deepcavepodcast.com. Really nice lady. I hope she gets the part. She's pushing to play Batgirl again for Joss Whedon in his film. And Joss, if you're listening, hey, come on, man. She's Batgirl.
And Joss, why wouldn't you be listening?
Seriously.
Yeah.
They're probably too busy with Justice League right now to have any fun.
Well, we know that DC listens. We know Warner Brothers listens. So, guys, come on. Give Kate a shot.
All right. So, as a...
I mean, if you won't let me be Batgirl, give her a chance. I've got a red beard. I could grow it out long enough to be a redhead.
Right.
Wow.
So, as reported on the Geek Cave podcast website, in an agreement with Warner Brothers, Hulu has acquired the exclusive streaming rights to every episode of the old TGIF. Woo-hoo. So, Full House, Family Matters, Perfect Strangers,
yes,
Hanging with Mr. Cooper, and Step by Step. Over 800 episodes. And that's all dropping toward the end of September, September 29th. That it almost will make it worth me getting Hulu. I remember watching Step by Step and really enjoying Step by Step. That was, it came out at about the right time for me to really get invested into it. Perfect Strangers was just slightly before my time. Like, I didn't understand most of the jokes, so watching it now would be a different kind of humor.
Yeah.
So, but there it is. If you grew up like we did kind of in the 90s, where you were watching TGIF and you looked forward to TGIF being on. Who's got you covered?
It was a great way to start your weekend.
I agree.
You didn't have to go to bed right away on Friday night. You got to watch some silly shows and then get up early and watch cartoons.
Yeah, which they don't do anymore.
No.
Not on network anyway.
No.
So Warwick Davis is going to be in the Han Solo movie. Ron Howard was being interviewed, and they asked him a question, when can we expect a Willow sequel? Or something to that effect. Or he's like, in the middle of this Han Solo interview, they talk about Willow, and he's like, well, he just casually mentioned that he hasn't directed Warwick Davis in a while. He looks forward to doing that in the Han Solo movie. Also basically ducking the question of whether or not there will be a Willow sequel, which, by the way, don't. Don't. It's fine.
Yeah, leave
the movie is fine.
Leave it.
Don't. Leave it alone. Warwick Davis himself has previously kind of revealed his involvement with other Star Wars films. You know, he's appeared in Return of the Jedi, Phantom Menace, Force Awakens, Rogue One, Star Wars Rebels, and is set to appear in Star Wars The Last Jedi. So, I mean, I think he's probably made about the most appearances of anyone since R2-D2.
Yeah, I think he's good.
Get down to it. So, it's not like it's so much a surprise as it is just a nice nod. It's like, I really enjoy his acting. I'm glad that he's still doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't seem to go a single month without having something sad to report, June Foray has passed away recently. Age 99, most people could be forgiven for not knowing who that is.
Yeah.
But we, oh Geek Cave audience, are not most people.
And if you don't know who she is, you will know her work.
Here in about 30 seconds. So June Foray, born September 18th, 1917, was best known as a voice actor for several cartoons. So her earliest work was in radio before eventually becoming the voice of some of the most famous characters in American animation. So for people our parents' age, mm-hmm. people who were born in the 50s and kind of had their childhood in the 60s and 70s, she was Rocky of Rocky and Bullwinkle fame.
Rocket J. Squirrel.
For those who watch those Saturday morning cartoons, she was Granny in the Sylvester and Tweety shorts.
Mm-hmm.
For those who are just slightly older than us, she was Aunt May in Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends in the early 80s. For us 90s kids, she was Grammy Gummy in The Adventures of the Gummy Bears. Also, she was Ma Beagle and Magica Dispel in DuckTales.
Woo!
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Her career spanned decades, impacted many of us in the film and television geekdom to this day. There are very few cartoons that, you know, that have those, we're going to say the distinctive voices that really just stick with us, but every one of us can remember Magica Dispel.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that sound, that da-link
yeah.
kind of thing. So, dear Lady of a Thousand Voices, thank you for sharing some of them with us.
Yeah, she on Rocky and Bullwinkle, she was also Natasha.
Ah, of course.
It's as someone who spent a lifetime watching cartoons and trying to emulate some of those voices, I have a deep appreciation for voice actors, and she was one of the best. She's right up there. So you will be sorely missed, June.
So I'm going to do some trailer stuff before we get into the Flashpoint thing.
All right.
Because I don't know how much of a conversation that will end up being.
That's fine.
But San Diego Comic-Con for us has just wrapped up pretty recently. By the time this goes up, it'll be in a couple weeks. But we've got a couple of trailers. You know, the new trailer for It was released. It's properly terrifying.
It is.
The use of Georgie's line, "You'll float too," repeated ad infinitum there toward the end, will likely give you shivers.
Yeah.
I'm still not sold on only telling the kids' story without the adults making the appearance, because that parallel was part of the structure of the book. You know, that.
And they even did that in the miniseries.
That made it just that much more terrifying. You know, the things that scared you as kids are different and yet the same as what terrifies you as an adult. But new medium, new structure. As long as the story's effective,
yeah.
I'm not terribly.
I like your idea of if they go back after this, if they go back and do the adult side,
mm-hmm.
and then you can get it on Blu-ray where everything is cut together like the book.
Special edition.
Yeah.
That would be a ridiculous level of director cut. I mean, just we're talking Blade Runner level of ridiculous.
And I'm okay with that if done right.
Yeah. Well, it won't have gained the kind of cultural zeitgeist of something like a Star Wars.
That's true. That's true.
And you'd still be able to get the original. So anyway, Thor Ragnarok got a trailer at San Diego Comic-Con. It's mm-hmm. funny. It's exciting. It's intense. It's decidedly different from the first two Thor movies. I love the font choices that they made. It's delightfully 80s. It kind of has a Guardians of the Galaxy tone to it and is probably the most 80s thing since Stranger Things.
Yeah.
You know? Speaking of which, season 2 of Stranger Things is set to be released on Netflix around Halloween. It seems that Will is not quite out of the Upside Down just yet, as it's encroaching on his everyday life, according to the trailer. It's good to see Eleven back. You know, we were a little bit... we were left ambivalent about her fate at the end of the first season, but she's in the trailer there. We assumed she'd be back, but confirmation's nice. Sorry, kids, though. Barb is gone for good, according to the directors. Everyone was hoping that Barb was going to make it. Turns out she is not.
Did everyone else just miss where she's dead? It's literally just me that noticed.
No, I noticed... I think I noticed I was sitting next to you when it happened. So
yeah, it's just like...
I screamed a little bit. I leapt into your arms. Those broad, muscly arms.
That show is so good.
So Avengers Infinity War had a trailer released at Comic-Con. And if you didn't see the leak on the day that it happened, then tough poop.
Yeah, Chad spent... at least an hour scouring the internet trying to find it.
So I could watch it. I missed out. So, too bad for me. Too bad for us. Apparently it was really good. We ended up Justin and I ended up watching a guy telling us what was in it.
Yeah.
And it sounds good.
Yeah?
I don't know why Marvel has such an aversion to releasing that trailer. DC... has been releasing their sizzle reels and all this stuff. Come on, guys.
Well, and that's exactly the next point I was going to make is Justice League's trailer's been released because Warner Brothers is planning on capitalizing on every single bit of time it has before the movie's released.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. So, I mean, and because we got to see the 4-minute sizzle reel of Justice League, the trailer, it's actually pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And there are little tiny moments. It's the tiny moments that have me excited about the characters. So there is a particular scene in the reel where Aquaman is basically surfing one of these alien things down through a building, lands on the street and jumps off of it like he's just hopped off a surfboard, and he shakes his hair.
Does his little hair flip.
Oh,
yeah.
that was refreshing.
Yeah.
You know, it's little moments like that thrill me. Or... when Commissioner Gordon looks around and only Flash is sitting there, he's like, oh, they really do disappear. Huh.
That was
rude. Rude. Zap. And then he's gone. I don't know if it's because there's a little bit of humor inherent in it or if it's because it's showing attention to character. You know, the little moments are what make a character. The big moments make a story.
Yeah.
The little moments make a character.
And that is exactly the kind of thing that Barry Allen's Flash would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd be slightly oblivious to the fact that everyone's gone, oh, okay.
sorry, we got to go. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited to see it. I don't know yet if I'm more excited to see it. By it, I mean, I don't know if I'm more excited to see Justice League or Thor Ragnarok right now, because quite honestly, Thor Ragnarok has me just kind of thrilled as the idea of having the Thor-Hulk dynamic play out in this thing. And I really want to see the Hulk-Fenrir matchup.
Well, and
that was the giant dog, by the way.
Yeah. And Hulk speaking in full sentences.
Yes, which a lot of people seem to forget that he did speak in the Avengers.
Yeah,
you know,
he did.
Puny god.
And in the Ed Norton version, he had a line.
Right. Yeah. Hulk, smash!
Something like that, yeah.
We forget that there is a bit of Bruce in the in the Hulk. And depending on how long he's been the Hulk, there might be a lot of Bruce in there. So I'm looking forward to both. It, like I said, it's a toss-up on which one I'm looking forward to most right now. So at San Diego Comic-Con, we got the title for the Ezra Miller Flash movie, Flashpoint. We heard the comic detail in the comic section. If you did not get the comic section, go back, listen to it. It's detailed, but it'll probably help make a lot more sense of the conversation that's about to occur.
Yeah, so wait. Okay.
So right now, we didn't get a date for that movie, but looking at it, it may very well be the 11th movie in DC's movie universe. So the question that's begging to be asked, is that too early for a Flashpoint shakeup? Now, we know your position on that, Justin.
Yeah.
So, Darren, what do you think right now? Is it too early?
I think it really depends partially on what Justin said. Are they going to stay true to the source material of Flashpoint, or is this just going to be something they call Flashpoint but ends up not having the same kind of lasting ramifications? Ultimately, it depends on how well they've done building their cinematic universe by that point. Because if Justice League flops, we might not have a cinematic universe. It might just go to standalones, for all we know. Now, Justice League probably won't flop, but I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence, because on one hand, I see how this would be one way to... Because there's been talk about Ben Affleck stepping away from Batman, and he's denied it, but Ben Affleck is a Batman that's in his 50s. If they want to keep this going for a while, they are going to need to kind of reset a couple of characters, especially if they want to do it as long as Marvel's been doing it. So I can see why they're looking at it. I think they're making a little bit of a mistake in not doing another iconic Flash story first. I think they're just going with, well, this is the Flash story everyone's known from the past few years, so that's the one we're going to do.
All right. Justin, rant away.
It's if they hold true to the Flashpoint storyline, or even, you know, in a vague sense, where Barry goes and mucks with the timeline.
Which is a thing Barry does.
Which is a thing Barry does, and it's been proven time and time again in just about every form of media that the Flash has appeared in.
Dumbest smart guy ever.
Yeah, it's too soon. It's too flippin' soon. They will only have had about 10 movies under their belt at that point. They will have just laid the foundation for what this cinematic universe is. And then it's basically buying like a 4-book series on something. You read the first one, it lays the ground level for what's going on, you like it, but in the second book, oh, we've changed everything around, and now you're in this foreign land.
We're looking at you, His Dark Materials.
Sure.
Whereas the Golden Compass books.
Ah, okay.
Golden Compass, Amber Spyglass.
Whereas with Marvel, the Infinity Wars have the ability to muck with the timeline and change things. The Infinity Stones can do that. It's a great MacGuffin. So at the end of the Infinity Wars, if there's something that needs to be tweaked within the Marvel Cinematic Universe to make phase, what are we on, 15? To make the next round of movies palatable for people who've been in it since the beginning and not just rehashing everything, that's the perfect time to do it. They've been going at it for almost 10 years, if not longer. No, longer. That's a perfect point to muck with stuff and fix what needs to be fixing, change what needs to be changed. Flashpoint is too soon. If you're gonna start tweaking things, just after the cement has dried on the foundation is not the time to do it. Don't dig up what you've already laid down just because you can. Build on it, then see what needs to be changed. It's just too soon. That's my opinion. And if they're not going to do the Flashpoint storyline, don't call it Flashpoint. Call it something else, because all you're doing is making me mad.
No, they could kind of weasel their way out by doing the Flashpoint story, but when Barry fixes things, everything just goes right back to the way it was. It's like nothing ever happened.
Yeah, I know, and that's a cop-out.
I said that's what I would expect.
Because I'm looking at this from a, and I'm using air quotes here, a scientific perspective, because Lord knows I'm not a scientist. Generally speaking, if you go and muck with the timeline, even if you try to, even if you, you know, stop yourself from doing what you did, there's always going to be something that's changed. Nothing is ever exactly the same. It's just one of those things.
Well, this will be third or fourth time through, so who knows.
Anyway, that's my little rant.
All right. So I have a nominee for this year's Crystal Steamer.
Oh.
For those of you who are fairly new to our podcast, the Crystal Steamer is our award for worst of the worst that is given out each January. So I'm just going to read you an excerpt from a Vanity Fair article regarding Angelina Jolie's new film, Unbroken. So it's effectively the story of how they auditioned the kids for the lead because they wanted, you know, that it's about Cambodia. They wanted Cambodian actors. Great. So to cast the children in the film, Jolie looked at orphanages, circuses, and slum schools, specifically seeking children who had experienced hardship. In order to find their lead to play young Long Ung, the casting director set up a game, rather disturbing in its realism. They put money on the table and asked the child to think of something she needed the money for, and then to snatch it away. The director would pretend to catch the child, and the child would have to come up with a lie. Srey Moch, the girl ultimately chosen for the part, was the only child that stared at the money for a very, very long time, Jolie says. When she was forced to give it back, she became overwhelmed with emotion. All these different things came flooding back. Jolie then tears up. Yeah, I'm sorry for her. When she was asked later what the money was for, the young actor said her grandfather had died and they didn't have enough money for a nice funeral. The authentic connection to pain was awakened in everyone involved, says Jolie, making for a film set like nothing she'd ever seen. There wasn't a person who was working on the movie who didn't have a personal connection. They weren't coming to do a job. They were walking in the exodus for the people whom they had lost in their family, and it was out of respect for them that they were going to recreate it. It completed something for them. Some had flashbacks and nightmares. For this reason, a therapist was on set every day, and then there were the odd bystanders who hadn't been aware that a movie was being made and were traumatized. In one scene, recalls Jolie, when the Khmer Rouge came over the bridge, we had a few people who really dropped to their knees and wailed. They were horrified to see them come back. End quotes. So this is straight up unacceptable behavior. Never mind the trauma for the people who didn't know there was a movie being made because there was no therapist for them.
Yeah.
Let's just say for the kids who auditioned, even if every single kid ended up with a bit of the money, that was still a traumatizing event. The kid who ended up with the role and now has the ability to afford funerals, that's still a traumatizing event. All for their desire for some kind of, quote, authentic, end quote, reaction. See, this is what happens when you don't trust your actors to know how to act. There's abuse. This is not all that far removed from, and I wish I could remember the name of the movie, although I don't want you to see it, where they literally raped a woman on camera, you know, and used that because the director wanted an authentic reaction.
I remember hearing about that
one. I'm glad you don't remember the name of it.
So, that is my nominee for a Crystal Steamer. I don't know if you want to do it for the film company or for Angelina Jolie or what, but I can, or just the casting director, but I am not going to see this movie specifically because of how they went about casting it. Can't do it.
I'm okay with nominating the group as a whole.
Yeah, they're all they're all implicit, and I am violently angry right now just from hearing that story. The movie you're referring to is Last Tango in Paris.
Yes.
Angry hearing about that as well. So it's a good thing I have a heavy bag in my home, because I have a feeling it's going to get a workout as soon as this episode's over.
So, trust your actors to act. If you need to abuse or traumatize, I mean, this is no different from Shelley Duvall's experience with The Shining.
Oh my God.
This is no different from the I Heart Huckabee story. I mean, it's just, if you can't get the response out of your actors as a director, then either you're a bad director or you've chosen the wrong actors.
Angelina Jolie, for all the bullshit she spouts about wanting to help kids, still being a part of this film speaks volumes.
Well, and this is her baby. This is her thing. So there is that. So I think that's most of the news. We'll talk about Extra Life at the very end. If you guys don't have anything else, I do have a random movie review to go to. Shall we? I know, right after a Crystal Steamer, we do something else and something
Kent,
not nearly so traumatic, but kind of boring.
Kent, just do it, Kent.
And now it's time for Chad Savage's Random Movie Review.
Okay, so for those new to the cave, Vil Coleman, you know, believe it or not, we're actually glad you've decided to join the sweetest smelling fandom on the interweb. Being new, you probably don't realize yet that through 2017, I'm planning to review one movie a month that has a place on the American Film Institute's top 100. So this month, the movie that crossed my Amazon Prime was Apocalypse Now. Justin and I sat down and watched it. We watched the theatrical version of the movie rather than the Redux version because we didn't want to sit for over 3 hours. For those who have seen this movie and really, really enjoy it, you may want to skip to the last few minutes of the podcast when we talk about Extra Life.
Yeah.
So Apocalypse Now is about Captain Willard, played by Martin Sheen, who is sent on a mission during the Vietnam War to kill Colonel William Kurtz, who's played by Marlon Brando. Kurtz has been determined to be insane and has built his own private army out of the native tribe inside neutral Cambodia. So it's an assassination mission. Willard, who is also a little broken, is initially ambivalent about the mission and joins a boat crew heading upriver. Eventually, they rendezvous with Robert Duvall, Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore, and convince him to attack a section of the river, basically by saying that there's good surfing there. Yes, it is as ridiculous as it sounds. Kilgore has some of the most memorable lines from the movie, such as, "Charlie, don't surf," as a reason to take the river beach there. And, of course, the famous, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning." So anybody who has heard that particular quote, now you know where it's from.
Yep.
As Willard and crew make their way further up the river, Willard falls deeper into his own madness and begins to understand Kurtz better and better. And eventually, they reach the northernmost outpost of the Nung River, which is absolutely chaotic. There's no clear chain of command. And kind of what epitomizes the worst parts of Vietnam in terms of no one knows what's going on, or at least nobody's claiming responsibility here. And then they get past that, and they reach Kurtz's camp, and everything is very peaceful. It's like there's the smell of death, etc., and there's, you know, heads on pikes and so forth. But no one's fighting. There's no random gunshots.
It's calm.
It's calm in a creepy way.
Yeah, it's eerie.
So upon arriving, Willard finds another soldier, Captain Colby, who was sent on the same mission earlier, but instead of completing the mission and killing Kurtz, he basically joined him. And over a time, Willard's kept with Kurtz, begins to understand him that much better, and despite coming to the conclusion that Kurtz was right in many of his methods, Willard knows that he must fulfill his mission and ends up killing Kurtz with a machete. As he's leaving the killing ground, Kurtz's followers bow down to Willard, basically offering him the status they had given Kurtz, effectively a demigod, you know, in terms of the level of respect and awe. But Willard takes the remains of his boat crew, gets in the boat, and heads back south. That is a gross oversimplification for a 2.5-hour movie.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of silence. There's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of discomfort. And this is one of those movies where you watch it for 2 hours, you look up the clock and realize that 20 minutes have gone by. If you're looking for a fast-paced war movie, you'll be disappointed. If you're looking for a movie with a real driving plot that won't let you go, you may want to look elsewhere. If you're looking for a movie that has a particular view of the Vietnam War and is willing to show that in an unflinching way, it's in the top three. You know, there's certainly, it's certainly critical. Although that's not entirely unexpected. Almost every American film about that uses Vietnam is critical.
Yeah.
Probably 99% of them. If you're looking for a character study of madness and its impact on the human psyche brought about by what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder, but back then was called operational exhaustion, then this may well be your Huckleberry. So I would list Apocalypse Now as one of those movies that should be studied. You know, we were watching it and we were like, oh, I'm between bored and irritated. But the more I thought about it and the more I reflected on it, it's important to know. It's important to be seen, but it's not all that fun or even all that entertaining to watch. I could see somebody maybe being entertained by it, but I see it much more as a movie of engagement than entertainment. This is a movie that's made to challenge the viewer. This is one of those movies where you watch it basically to say, okay, how did they do this? What are they trying to say? What's the format? And while the story is relatively simple, and believe me, I was sorely tempted to name this just the worst road movie I've ever seen and going on and being flippant, I think it'd be doing a disservice to the film by reflecting only on its entertainment value. So this film, at its base, it's a study of madness. Willard himself talks about being insane for wanting to come back to Vietnam after having been sent home. And this insanity of his own makes him the perfect choice to face Kurtz's insanity. The two of them are effectively on the same path, just at different points. And as Willard travels upriver to find Kurtz, each mile further north shows more and more the insanity of war. And it begins almost immediately on he gets on a boat and there's a crew on the boat, and the boat crew is just disconnected. You know, one of the guys, he skis behind the boat that's heading upriver through occupied Vietnam. And then a little bit further, and we meet Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore, who plans his race based on the ability to surf and has one of the most iconic scenes in the movie where they fly the helicopters into the Ride of the Valkyries, which is a great scene, and calls in the napalm strike, which at the time was the largest filmed explosion. I think Tropic Thunder beat it. Like, I think that was... I'm convinced that's half the point of why Tropic Thunder was made, was to have a bigger explosion. But, and eventually, when they reach kind of this northernmost post, the chaos is overwhelming to the point of discomfort as a viewer. You know, a lot of times when there's chaos in a movie, it's frustrating or it's irritating because, like, well, what's happening? You know, you're supposed to be telling this coherent story. Here, they don't want to tell the coherent story. You know, that final post where he's looking for the CO and nobody knows who the CO is or even where the CO is. The chaos is there specifically to be chaotic, to put us in this position of not knowing. And I'd say it is overwhelming at points. When we finally get into Kurtz's kingdom and that heart of darkness, both in the macro sense of the war and the micro sense of Willard's mind, because this entire movie, Willard's been slowly descending deeper into Kurtz's mind as well as his own madness, we get a sense that this is the real turning point of the movie and for the character. And I want to make something clear for those of you who are listening and think that the river thing is half the movie and half the movie is with Kurtz and his madness and Marlon Brando. Marlon Brando's character doesn't show up until the last half hour of the movie, maybe. So you go 2 hours of just building this tension and seeing this descent into Willard's madness and his adoption of kind of a killer identity, you know. And when they finally reach Kurtz and you're expecting, you know, this lean fighting person who's you know, well regarded, or at least was well regarded as a soldier, and instead you see this, you know, old kind of broken, bejeweled man. It's jarring. It's like they did such a wonderful job of building up who this guy is and then just shattering it. And yet he still has this cultish following. But there are two distinctive points of note at this turning point in the movie. If Willard kills Kurtz or not is the first turning point. You know, if he kills him, then he'll be accepting Kurtz's insanity and the need to be eliminated. You know, this guy is clearly out of his gourd. If he doesn't kill Kurtz, then he's accepting the philosophy and he becomes another soldier in the kingdom. You know, and then the U.S. government has to send another assassin, which Willard's already the second one. So, yeah. If Willard kills Kurtz, he does, by the way, with a machete, then his last choice, and this is the final turning point, is does he accept the role of God within the tribe? You know, because once he leaves the temple where he's killed Kurtz, he's fulfilled his mission, he's assassinated this insane man, and as he steps out of the temple, the entire tribe is watching him and bows down to him. He is given godhood in this little kingdom. And he could take it and basically becomes the next Kurtz. Or he walks away from the power and the madness and tries to return home. Which is what he does, but we get the sense that he's still changed. Like, he is forever changed. He's had to stare into this darkness within himself and in the war, and he will never, ever be what he was. We get the sense that Willard will never have a happy life, that he will never be a satisfied, self-differentiated man. But that final decision is also what differentiates Willard from Kurtz. And the movie suggests that this sets his mind right. You know, the movie suggests that, okay, now that he knows who he is and what he's done, he can at least go on with his life. I'm not entirely certain. The movie tells us this basically with two visuals. In the very opening scene, there is a statue superimposed with Martin Sheen's face, and they're 180 degrees turned. And at the end of the movie, they're in sync, and they start to merge together. I'm not sure I buy it. So, on reflection, and some more reflection, and some argument, and a little bit more reflection after that, the movie does deserve to be seen. In terms of the American Film Institute's top 100 of important films, it probably deserves to be there. And I've not even mentioned the production issues that went into place.
Oh my God.
The production issues, just look up a Wikipedia article on the production problems with this. It was huge. There were so many problems in trying to make this movie. It's a miracle it was made in the first place. But just because a movie was hard to make doesn't mean that the product is going to be a good, entertaining one. It's uncompromising in its portrayal of many aspects of the Vietnam War. It isn't afraid to show American soldiers when they're not at their best. And so be like me and watch the film, but walk in with your eyes open as to what you're going to experience. This is not a fun movie. Not. It's a challenging metaphorical ride that will ask much of you and will beg to be discussed later. So this is the most shaky be like me I have ever given. And I wish I could do a little bit better for that. So, but you know, in terms of movies, it is one. And you can't separate it from some of its woes, but I didn't want to color right with that. So before we close out, we would like to remind you, all of you who are listening, to check out our Extra Life campaign pages. You know, you can go to extra-life.org and search for any of our names. You can search for the Geek Cave podcast and donate to us as a team. You can find us from our homepage, geekcavepodcast.com/extralife2017. We've got some great prizes, including a Nintendo Classic Mini, and there's no minimum donation required to qualify. You know, help us help sick kids, and the Children's Miracle Network will be playing over Labor Day weekend. We'll be recording our next podcast live while we're playing. We'll be playing that same Nintendo Mini that we'll be giving away, just to make sure it works.
Yeah, just to make sure.
So tune in, donate, and help out as you can. We'd really appreciate it. We are brought to you by Shirtosaurus, BuzzTime, and GameStop. For Kent Harris, Darren Wright, Justin White, I'm Chad Savage, and remember, everyone is a geek for something.